Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would life be like for a creative soul trapped in a literal holding pattern in the sky above the city of Dallas for decades on end? How would a normal person react in the case of a zombie attack on a shopping mall? And would there be any hope for the survival of a marriage threatened by distance, infidelity, and the accidental reduction of one partner to the height of a coffee mug? Author Manuel Gonzalez uses surreal circumstances like these to explore more universal questions about life, morality, human purpose, and relationships in his debut book of short fiction, The Miniature Wife and Other Stories. Manuel Gonzalez is also executive director of Austin Bat Cave, a nonprofit writing organization for children and teenagers, and he was kind enough to drive up to our studios today to talk about his work. Manuel, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And I should say, welcome back home. You're originally from Plano.
Yeah, I grew up in Plano. Was here until I was 18, and then fled.
It is interesting that some of the people who have looked at your work, you know, from other places, are really obsessed with the idea that you are from Plano, as if like a writer couldn't emerge from this part of the country.
Well, you know, one of my friends from graduate school came down to Plano. A number of them came down for my wife's and I marriage. And he stepped out and looked at the neighborhood where I grew up. And he looked at me and said, "This is where you grew up? Where did all the weird stuff come from?" Because it does seem, well, to me, it always reminded me of the neighborhoods in Edward Scissorhands, or mm-hmm. just very, very neat lawns, very tidily kept houses. And that's where I came from.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that causes your mind to just, you know, create things where they don't exist.
Yeah, I did that even when I was a kid. I would always think about why I didn't have more drama in my life. In fact, I yelled at my parents at one point when I was younger about how we had too normal of a life, and it made me feel inadequate to all my friends who had drama.
Well, you know, in the story Pilot, Co-Pilot, and Writer, this is a story where, as it opens, our narrator has been hijacked on a plane circling over the city of Dallas for 20 years,
right,
with this perpetual oil substance that keeps the plane up and some kind of drops that the pilot is able to keep everyone alive. And it struck me, is that the sort of thing? Are you just sort of waiting to taxi in and then your mind goes off on these flights of fancy?
Well, yeah, that story specifically, I was living in Houston, but for work and for other things, I had to take maybe 3 or 4 flights over a 4-week period, and felt as I was going from one airline to another that I really was on the plane all the time. And then I thought, well, what if I were?
Well, and the writer who narrates this, it's interesting, becomes very, very separated from everything he once cared about. Not only his relationships with people on the ground, but ultimately with the other people who he's sharing this experience with on the airplane. And then he writes about the fact, you write about the fact that we have this sort of tacit agreement with people that we sit next to on planes, right? That we can form a pretty deep bond, but it's time sensitive.
Right. And then if it goes on too long, then if you are stuck on the tarmac and you have a flight that's delayed for an hour, then you get to look at each other and shrug and say, oh, what next? And that strengthens that bond. But as it goes for longer, you start to feel constricted. I always feel constricted by the fact that I now have some obligation to continue to acknowledge the people around me who are strangers. I just felt like if this kept going on, then you just take it to its nth degree, then the narrator would be completely isolated from everybody, or feel like he should be or would want to be.
How do you feel about the term magical realism?
Well, I like the term magical realism, I guess. I like Garcia Marquez's work, and I know that a lot of people do use that term for my work. I don't ever really think of it as magical realism. I feel like Garcia Marquez played with magical realism in a way to make these very difficult situations in, you know, in Latin America and give them some kind of beauty that would explain why people still flocked there and still tried to have burgeoning lives there. And I tried to bring these weird magical or science fictional elements into the stories to kind of undermine the stuff that goes on, or speak to the less beautiful things that are going on in our lives. And I think that there's mainly just an intent that's different, you know, from what Garcia Marquez was doing or from Isabel Allende or any of the other magical realists. And usually I like to associate my own influences back to Borges, who uses magical elements as well, but more for philosophical reasons in his short fictions. But, you know, I do see why people often think of magical realism, and I don't disagree with those elements that are in the story.
Let's talk about, is it Life on Capra 2? That's the story.
Right.
Okay, so we may have to give a little of this away in order to discuss it. Is that okay
with
you? That's
fine. Yeah, no, I think, yeah.
Okay, so you've got the whole story starts and you've got someone like in a swamp fighting robots,
right,
and a swamp monster and has just seen his buddy blown to bits. And then there's sort of almost a Groundhog Day. Everything starts over and his buddy is alive and then gets killed again and over and over. And finally, the character starts to say, you know, I can't remember the last time like I took a shower or what we discover is this is a character in a like a first person shooter game.
Right, right. And that it was an interesting development, that story, because really at the time that I thought of the first sentences of that story, I was in the middle of writer's block for a larger project that I just couldn't get to work. And I was so frustrated with the writing process that I took a break from it and said, well, what's the dumbest, funniest, weirdest sentence that I could write? And so I wrote the sentence about we finally bagged the swamp monster and then the robots attack. And I wrote maybe the next few sentences and then stopped because I was like, what is this story even about or where is it going to go? And then set it aside and didn't really think about it. I liked the sentences, but I didn't think it was going to go anywhere. And then a year later, after the collection had gone into editing, there was a story that none of us really liked anymore. And I didn't want the collection to be a story lighter than it was. So I was like, well, I could go back and see if I could write something else quickly and went back to that. And I thought, well, this guy is obviously in a video game because where else are you going to have swamp monsters and robots at the same time? And then from there, it just kind of built.
I think it's interesting because it does sort of, you can't help but reflect on your own consciousness and whether it's valid or not.
Right, right. And yeah, and I also like the idea, well, what if this guy actually just gained consciousness and this whole world, and he was the only one, and he was trying to reconcile everything that was going on with this sudden understanding of the not rightness of his place in there. And then also I like to play with all of the first-person shooter tropes where you're in these weird locations. There's no real reason for you to be where you are.
You've got a mission.
You've got a mission, but the mission always seems kind of patched together. You can switch guns at will, and you have all these strange creatures. And this really tired background story. excuse me. And it's it was just fun from there. And yeah.
I mean, it's just a real skill to be able to take a universal sensation, which is that we're the only ones who have these feelings. We're the only ones who are sort of conscious to the way the world really works, and everyone else around us is kind of you know, playing a script. Do you ever start with the idea and then build a story around it? Or it sounds like some of these happen in the opposite direction.
Yeah, usually I get just a kernel or a notion of a situation that a character would be in. Like with the pilot, co-pilot, I thought, what if a person like me was stuck on a plane forever? With Life on Capra, what if a person like me was in a video game and all of a sudden woke up? The story All of Me, which is the first-person narrative about a zombie who is just an office worker and
wants to bite his boss's face off.
Wants to bite his boss's face off, but not personally. It's just the zombie.
He's just hungry.
He's just hungry. And he was in love, desperately in love. That one, I wrote it just before all of the zombie stuff happened, but there was a story on NPR about the re-release of Dawn of the Dead and how zombie just literature kind of kept coming back, as zombie literature, I guess, would. And I just thought to my, it just popped into my head, well, why wouldn't there be a zombie story from the point of view of the zombie? And then what would that guy be like? And then, yeah, so usually it's just a little idea, a what if statement, and then the world kind of builds around that.
And then with, it seems like with short fiction, you have to be so careful to decide what belongs in the story and what can be left unsaid.
Right. And usually a lot of it can be left unsaid. I think that's a common mistake when trying to tackle a short story with students that I've worked with, is that they feel like there should be so much. They have so much story to tell, but in a short story, you don't have very much room or real estate to tell it in. And so you have to really pick and choose what is important in your story. And it's usually you write a lot and then you go back and you cut out everything that doesn't work.
My guest is author Manuel Gonzalez. He is executive director of Austin Bat Cave, a nonprofit writing organization for children and teenagers, and author of the new collection, The Miniature Wife and Other Stories. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before we come back to the conversation, I want to let you know that if you are ready to make your contribution to KERA at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. Among the fantastic thank you gifts that we have for you is a copy of The Miniature Wife and Other Stories by Manuel Gonzalez. Jeff and I both just really were taken with this book the moment that it came in, and we're very excited to be able to get Manuel on the show. If you are a lover of short fiction, of the surreal, it's something that I think will be very interesting to you.
Yeah, and here's to Riverhead, too, for supporting new authors and story writers, because they have a history. Well, we have a history with interviewing some of those kinds of authors here on the show, and it's really exciting to see this kind of fiction out there. And we're thrilled to be able to bring the conversation to you. If that's worthy of a little bit of support, today is a great day to do it. Chris, just $68,000 left to raise in the membership campaign. And as you mentioned a minute ago, if you'd like to get your very own copy of Manuel's book, The Miniature Wife and Other Stories, we'll thank you with a copy of it when you join the station with a $10 a month contribution. Of course, the book's out. It's available, but we would love to be able to send you a copy with our thanks when you call 888-694-6931 or when you contribute at kera.org. You know, Chris, many listeners have given generously $5, $10, $20 a month to pay for the great programming that we provide to them every single day. What you hear is worth every penny on KERA. But those that give $365 or $1,500 a year or more may give to make KERA available to everyone who lives in North Texas. These folks allow us to invite everyone into the conversation and to experience the great journalism from public radio reporters around the world. If you can today make a little bit higher level gift, it would really help us raise this remaining now $66,000 and provide this service to everyone.
Yeah, you can think of yourself really as a benefactor of quality journalism, which is something that many people believe is in short supply today. Thankfully, not in the realm of public radio, but it exists and is solid and strong because of contributions from people just like you. Some of you may be in a position to give at the Friends level of $1,500 or more. Lots of us are able to give at more modest amounts, but amounts that really count to KERA. Your contribution of $5 or $10 or $20 or $50 a month will help to keep this programming that you love on KERA 365 days a year, 366 in leap years. Go to KERA.org now or call 1-888-694-6931.
It's really, really important we hear from you. Today is the last day of this campaign, so just $66,000 left to raise. I want to thank Brooke Aragai and Hurst and Martha and Chris Gensheimer in Fort Worth and Harry Zimmer in Euless, and also want to thank all the folks who give anonymously, who choose not to have their name read on the air. You're all Monday membership campaign heroes. Please be the next one to call 888-694-6931. Help us in the drive with a contribution online at kera.org.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Manuel Gonzalez. His new collection of short fiction is called The Miniature Wife and Other Stories. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So I love the story, The Artist's Voice, which is about a composer who is compelled to keep creating music, but for inexplicable reasons is essentially physically paralyzed by the act of creating music.
Right.
But he can't stop.
No.
Is that just the story of every artist, including yourself, that you've ever known?
Yeah, I don't know if it's every artist, but myself, it's really difficult for me to stop creating regardless of all of the other things that I might have to attend to. And it does become, if I don't, over a number of days, get some writing time in or some thinking time about my writing in, I become really a horrible person to live with. So it's in my family's best interest that I get some time now and again. But the story specifically, I remember there was, I don't know why, but there were like a number of nights when I was in New York and I couldn't sleep very well because I had this strong back pain. And I was also in the middle of trying to write something for a workshop and I couldn't get it to work either. And so instead I thought about this guy and this story and just created that very odd scientific thing.
Why do you think, Manuel, that all of us want to be, you know, sort of known and understood, at least by the people that we care about, but only some people are compelled to write or to create art?
I don't know. That's a very good question, because I know a number of people who could be really good writers. They are just very just really good with words and with telling stories, but they don't have the compulsion to sit down, or they say that they don't have any ideas for what they would sit down and write, whereas I have ideas that come to me in the most inopportune times, and they come to me all the time.
Like zombies?
Like zombies. I will be just driving in the car, and I won't have any way for me to write down the stories that I come up with just seeing a billboard or seeing a person in a car next to me. But I'm not sure why I can't stop. And then there are a number of very good people who never start. But it does, to me, feel like a compulsion. It seems there was just one morning after my sophomore year in college, one summer morning, I woke up and I had a story in my head and I just started writing. And since then, I haven't really stopped. It hasn't always been very good. Most of it hasn't been very good, but I just can't stop the practice.
Do you feel like usually it's a blessing and sometimes it's a curse, this compulsion?
I think it's always a blessing. I really like it. I know a number of writers, and I've listened to a number of other writers in interviews say that they like having written rather than the actual writing. But for me, the writing itself is even more interesting and pleasurable than having written something. It's nice to see the thing as a finished product, but by that time, I'm usually into another thing that I'm working on that is what is giving me all that satisfaction. I just really like the compulsion. It never really seems like, I mean, in terms of financially, maybe there are probably a number of other jobs that I could have done that would have paid better and offered more security. but in terms of the actual being compulsed to write, I really like that about me.
So the collection is named for this one story called The Miniature Wife, which is really remarkable. This guy who works in a top secret lab, miniaturizing things, we're led to believe maybe for the government, but we don't know, finds one day he comes home and his wife somehow has been shrunk down to 3 inches high. And then the question we're forced to ask is whether the real problem is her physical diminishment or the fact that he has really failed to see her or listen to her for some time.
Right. Yeah. And that's, I kind of like playing with that line in a lot of my stories where there really is a physical thing that is, if you just read it on the surface level, that would be the story. And it would still hopefully be satisfying as a story. But if you wanted to, you could go back and reread it and try and find different elements to it. I like the fact that the wife is made small by her husband instead of miniaturized, but just maybe made small or neglected or whatever. And then it ends in a horribly violent way, and which I think might actually well, maybe it went further than most relationships, but, you know, if there is that disparity between the way partners see each other, then, yeah, it usually ends in some bit of a split. So you can take it that way, but usually when I start a story, it's really just with that very surface story in mind at first, and then if the layers haven't already been added while writing it, I'll usually go back and try and add more layers to it.
It's interesting to me that you really balance. There is a lot of like genuine pathos in the story and sorrowful things that happen, and then there is like just wicked like dark humor that pops up in the strangest times. I won't give anything away in this one, but there's an incident with a bird, and I wonder if you just instantly know as you're writing, okay, we need to lighten this up here or twist it a little bit, or if later on you go back and think, well, this needs work.
Usually what it is that I go back and add is more of the pathos, because I usually hold back a lot of that when writing. It's a natural instinct.
Because you don't want it to be too much?
I'm always afraid of being sentimental. And then, you know, readers of mine or my agent or my editor will come back and they'll say, you need to give us more. You can afford to be more on the nose here about the emotion that's going on here, which is, even when they tell me that, it's always a little uncomfortable for me. My tendency is towards the dark humor of everything, and it's always knowing in my own head that there's this emotional pathos that's going on, but it usually takes some prodding for me to put that onto the page.
I'm curious about when you put together a collection of short fiction, choosing the order that the stories will come in. Is it more important than, you know, a musician deciding how an album will play out?
Well, I really liked choosing the order. I had a very specific idea in mind where my hope was that things would get progressively more falling apart as you went further into the story, into the collection. The order of it is more or less the way I had originally laid it out before we sent it out. There were a couple of rearrangements, but I did want it to feel like you would get a progression as you read through it. I know that a lot of people don't read a short story collection cover to cover, but on the off chance that somebody did, I wanted there to be an arc that they could see that there was this kind of disintegration of things as it went further and further along.
I read that you have, are you still working on the Tumblr project where you're doing like every week a new story?
For a year we were doing every week. A friend of mine in New York, Emily Raw, she's a photographer, and she and I came up with this Tumblr project just over a year ago, and she would send me 3 photos a week, and I would pick one of them and write a story, 1,000 words or less, to it. And post it. There were a couple of weeks that we brought in other photographers and other writers. But for a year, I did it more or less for a story a week. And we're still working on the Tumblr, but we're adding a kind of snake eating its tail thing to it, where 'cause a lot of the photography that she does is portraits of musicians, usually based on, she styles them based on some songs that they've written. Mm-hmm. So they've written a song, and she's based a photograph on it, and then I wrote a story to one of them, and then that musician decided to write a song to the story I wrote, and then Emily decided to craft another photo to the song that she wrote about the story that I wrote about the original photo. And so we thought that that was kind of fun, and it's nice to have music involved, and so we're going to do maybe 2 a month now where we're going to involve another artist. I think this year it's going to be musicians. And then she said something about maybe bringing in chefs next year, but I think we should take it slow.
Looking at this collection, I don't know. Some of these would make for bad recipe ideas.
I know. They would. I don't know. It would maybe like the Futurist cookbook. I don't know if they have some really bad recipes in that book.
So I want to talk a little bit about your work with children and teenagers. First of all, like, what have you learned about the best way to constructively offer criticism to a young writer who may, on top of still just learning how to do this thing, be very sensitive to any kind of negative feedback.
Well, and that's the thing. We tell our volunteers really what our job is to shine a light on the work that the students are doing, mm-hmm. encourage them to do more, pick out the things that you think are really interesting, and then encourage more of that. If they're really funny, if they're telling a heartbreaking story, whatever it is that you can grab hold of and say, do more of this. This is amazing. I really want to see more. I want to read more. Send me more of this. And then as they become more confident in the writing, because a lot of them are very against writing, it's a very difficult thing for them. It's certainly not a fun thing for them. And so we try to make it something fun, mainly by tapping into what it is they might like to write about anyway, and then just encouraging them. And then as they start to open up to us, we say things like, this is really, really interesting. You know, what would make it easier for people to understand your stories if you added more details? What are some of the things that were also going on? What are some of the feelings that you were having right there? And we don't really niggle too much about grammar, mm-hmm. or sentence structure or how the page is written. We if we put them in one of our anthologies, because we do an anthology every year of student work, then we'll let them know we're going to have you do some edits and it's just because of these things. But usually we just really focus on getting them used to telling their stories and used to discovering their own writing voice or their own storytelling voice, because a lot of them, they don't even think in those terms, which not very many people do, but once they do, it kind of gives them a power over their life up to that point and themselves moving forward. I think that's really, though, the key element is just to make sure that they can't write anything wrong, and that what they write, we will find a way to make them write more of it because of how much we are interested in it.
Does it make you crazy that people who don't write assume short stories are the easy introduction and a novel is really the hard work?
Well, you know, it never really frustrates me. I understand why you'd think that. But also in workshops, usually what people do is they work on the short story, which doesn't really make sense because the short story itself is so different from the novel. Mm-hmm. And it's not that one is easier or a stepping stone into the other. They're both just completely different beasts. But I do think it's interesting that people have that sense. And I might have had that too, even before I started really diving into writing short stories. I like them both, which is good, because it's nice to have one to go, you know, when I get stuck on one, then I can jump to the other.
Manuel Gonzalez is author of the new collection of short fiction, The Miniature Wife and Other Stories, and he's executive director of Austin Batcave, a nonprofit writing organization for children and teenagers. Manuel, it's been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I want to say, I've lived in Houston, and I live in Austin now, and I lived in New York, and living in Dallas, I always thought that KERA had by far the best programming throughout the day. And so I do encourage everybody. I think maybe everybody can finish the 68,000 in the next 20 minutes.
Thank you so much. We should have had you on days ago. Thank you, Manuel. Have a great
day.
Thank
you.
Thanks to all of you who are listening this afternoon. We really appreciate your participation. Coming up, we want to let you know that we have selections from my January 2012 interview with Navy sniper Chris Kyle, who, as you may have heard, was killed over the weekend along with another man at a shooting range in Erath County. That will be coming up after this break. Right now, we are going to take the focus back to the matter at hand in raising money so that KERA can continue to bring you quality coverage, continue to bring you guests like Manuel Gonzalez, who has written this really fascinating, incredibly creative collection of short stories called The Miniature Wife and Other Stories. We do have copies of that available at the $10 a month or above membership level. You can get yours by calling KERA.org, or rather calling 1-888-694-6931, or going online to KERA.org. Jeff Whittington is back with us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. $65,000 left to raise, and the drive is over. This is the last day. This is your chance right now to call 888-694-6931. It just ticked down to $64,000 left to
Fantastic.
Go, Chris. 888-694-6931, or click and contribute online at KERA.org. org. I want to thank Deborah Schweiss in Addison, Cleta Willingham in Fort Worth, also Sam Tuleman in Dallas, and Julia King in Dallas. Also want to thank Elaine Versick in Arlington, Kunfeng Dong in Frisco, Shaskar Banerjee in Dallas, and Arti Ramamurti in Allen. Thank you so much to each of you for making your contribution. Please join these fine folks, these Monday membership campaign heroes, by calling 888-694-6931 or contributing at kera.org.
Your dollars make it possible for us to bring you people like Manuel Gonzalez to talk about his work, his approach to writing. This is not simply a little blurb. It's not simply a review. This is an in-depth conversation with the author himself that provides insight whether you're a writer yourself, whether you're a reader of fiction, just, you know, a discussion about the human condition, really. And, of course, in the last hour, we heard from the folks at the Cowan Center for Education, and that was a really great discussion, all made possible by you and by your devotion to lifelong learning, and frankly, at the end of the day, made possible by your dollars.
Just $64,000 left to raise. If you would make your contribution right now at 888-694-6931 or on the web at kera.org, we can get there. Today is the ninth on-air day of the drive, and Chris, I want to remind everybody that this evening at 7 p.m. or when we raise the last dollar of this $64,000, we're going to draw a lucky winner from the entire contribution group of everybody who's given during the drive. One lucky winner will walk away with a brand new 16-gigabyte iPad. Another lucky winner will walk away with a trip for two to Washington, D.C., where you'll get to meet Diane Rehm and hosts from NPR flagship shows, either All Things Considered or Morning Edition. You'll get to see those broadcasts as they happen. What an opportunity. Make your call right now to 888-694-6931.
If you happen to be our winner, you won't even have long to wait, just a few hours before you find out, which is always exciting. So make your contribution to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Receive as your thank you gift a copy of Manuel Gonzalez's fascinating book, The Miniature Wife and Other Stories. That's available today at the $120 contribution level, $10 a month on the sustaining membership plan. $64,000 to go. We are definitely wrapping up today. We will wrap up at 7 or 7:30 if we have not reached that amount. But if we get to it, as soon as we get there, we are going to stop things. So your contribution now will make a difference to the station. 888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. A 25-year-old Iraq war veteran is being charged with capital murder for the weekend attack on 38-year-old Navy veteran Chris Kyle and his friend Chad Littlefield at an Erath County shooting range. Investigators say the slain men, both married with children, may have offered to meet Eddie Ray Ruth at Rough Creek Lodge in an effort to help him cope with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. They are not sure why Ruth allegedly turned his handgun on Kyle and Littlefield at close range. Chris Kyle's shooting death is both sad and ironic, given that he survived four tours of duty during Operation Iraqi Freedom and was recognized as the most lethal military sniper in U.S. history, with 150 kills officially confirmed by the Pentagon. Kyle joined me in the studio of in January of last year for a candid conversation about his remarkable life and armed forces career. What follows is an edited archive of that interview. The rest is available as an online archive at keranews.org. You went through all this training before 9/11 ever happened. I wonder if you can describe for me, were you excited? Did you have a feeling in the pit of your stomach? How did you feel when that attack took place?
I was in awe. I couldn't believe that it had happened. I was just thinking, why would anyone do that? We're not really at war with anyone. I mean, why come and hit us like that? And especially, why hit civilians? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to attack, it's bad enough that they're hitting the embassies overseas, hitting our guys and girls who are deployed to protect. But now you're coming to our homeland and it made me feel vulnerable and felt sick to my stomach.
So talk a little bit about what your SEAL team was assigned to do the first time you got to Iraq.
We were supposed to take down all the oil fields. Simultaneously, the oil fields, the metering stations, and the offshore, were called GOPLATs, Gulf Oil Platform, those ones out at the sea, the drilling rigs.
So that they have no fuel to conduct their operations?
No, ma'am. It's because in Desert Storm, he flooded the Gulf there with all the oil.
Mm-hmm.
So we were trying to stop a natural disaster, stop him from setting fire to all the oil wells again. So we didn't have the big environmental damage going on.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as we took that down, then the invasion launched. And then we were just trying to help the Marines.
What kind of relationships do you have with the other military branches? And with you also worked with the Iraqi Army in some cases?
Right. That deployment naturally was not with the Iraqi. But with the other branches, it's always kind of like a big brother type situation. You're going to make fun of them and you're always going to tease them and put them down. But if somebody else jumps on them, you're going to pick up for them. Because you have pride in your unit, and then you're going to put everybody else down for not being you or in your unit. But then if you're out somewhere and a civilian was to make fun of a soldier or a Marine, you're going to all of a sudden see the two military guys come together.
Is the communication really good across the different branches?
Initially, it was not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of egos, too, in special operations. And we've had to work really hard over all those deployments trying to prove to them, hey, we don't have an ego. We're no better than you. We have different training than you do, and I have a little bit better gear, but we're all doing the same job, and we're all here to help.
The one thing, you've been in incredibly dangerous situations multiple times. You still hate heights.
Yes, ma'am. I always have hated heights. That's something I can't get over. Although I do love sitting on the outside of the helicopter, you know, on the little bird there,
mm-hmm.
on the butt plates, flying around. The helicopters I love, but airplanes,
jumping out of one is another thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Even riding an airplane sometimes still kind of a little uneasy, doesn't freak me out. But jumping out of the thing, it just does not seem natural at all.
Does it surprise you that you can literally stare death in the face in so many situations and still have this fear that maybe doesn't bother somebody who pushes papers for a living?
No, everybody's built differently. I mean, I'm no different than anybody else. I just did a different job. I'm your average, everyday, next-door guy.
So let's talk about your emergence as the number one sniper on record in U.S. military history. You didn't necessarily go with this as your primary plan, but it emerged as something that you were doing. You had concerns before you were ever deployed about whether you could ever take a human life.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, it's... Growing up, the only time you ever shot anything was when you were hunting and you were going to eat it.
Yeah.
So it was hard trying to wrap my mind around, well, how can I shoot another human being? And even the first time I had to do it, they're yelling at me, you have to do it. Take it. Take it. And it's still just trying to get over the fact of, wow, I'm fixing to have to kill someone. And then you do it because you have to think of it differently, that you're not killing a person. You're killing an enemy that if you don't do it, they're going to kill your guys.
Do you, I mean, is that part of your training to think of the enemy as somehow less than human in those situations?
Not really. I just think that's the way a lot of us deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to dehumanize it so you're not going crazy.
Your first kill was actually complicated in some ways. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was during the invasion. I wasn't even a sniper yet. And the Marine Corps is coming into a town, and we're already in the town trying to help soften the target a little bit so they're not getting completely chewed up. And the townspeople were coming out to show their support of the Marine Corps, say, come on in, we're not going to fight. Well, there was a woman in the crowd who was walking with them, going out to greet the Marines, pulled a grenade, pulled the pin, and kept walking towards the Marines to go greet them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I was ordered, you have to shoot her, you have to do it. And I definitely hesitated, and because not only am I killing another human being, now I'm killing a woman. So it was difficult, but it was either I do it or the Marines die.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to pick up and keep going. There's no time to really process that in the moment. Is that something that happens later whenever you finally get to sleep, or how does that work?
Not so much when you get to sleep. I found that with our operational tempo that you just kept going, going, going. And then it's when you finally have your break, to when you go back to base or you come back home, is when everything finally sets in. And that's when you have your time to think. And that's when I, you know, especially when you come home from deployment, they were really good about giving us about 4 weeks off just to kind of decompress, hang out, do whatever, and lay low. And that's when you're just trying to reprocess everything.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, those are really challenging times for you and for a lot of people who also have wives and families, because you have just left this really traumatic experience and now you're back in what used to be the real world that maybe doesn't feel quite the same anymore.
Definitely. And then you come home and you find people are doing their day-to-day lives. I don't know what I expected. It's not like the whole world's just going to stop and all of a sudden just stand around, do nothing, go, oh, there's a war going on.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has to continue doing their jobs, or otherwise what's the point in us even being over there if nothing's going on at home? But it caught me off guard coming home and going, wow, does anybody even know? But of course they did. It's all over the news. It's all you heard about. So it was hard. And then you're always worried over there driving, looking for IEDs on the side of the road. So when first time you're driving home, you're thinking, you know, see a little piece of trash blow across the highway. You're like, ooh, should I swerve? Or you're still kind of in the mindset, but you're trying to take yourself out of it.
Does it work the same way when you get back there, when you're redeployed? Are you a little bit calm at first, or are those defenses up right away?
No, I think you're already building your defenses before you deploy. And then when you get there, I think you're probably on extremely high alert. But then as you get into combat more and more and more, it gets more comfortable and you get more used to it. As funny as that sounds, but then you start to relax a little bit more.
So, Chris, a lot of the situations where you were acting as a sniper were in urban settings. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Special complications there.
Well, now you can no longer shoot and move. A sniper's whole job is you're supposed to be unseen.
Mm-hmm.
You take a single shot and then you relocate. That way they can't find you. Well, here in the city, you can't move. The first time you're going to take your shot usually is going to be in the daylight, and you can't be out on the street moving around. And you have to go in with a bigger force. It's not just me out there. I've got a team with me that's there for protection, because now as soon as I take that shot, it's a fighting position. And I have my radio guys controlling the air overhead. I've got my automatic machine gunners and everything that's going on, depend on who all the other support activities are that are around. But it's basically we're going out as an army and just trying to secure a location.
What are your guys looking for, and what are you looking for when you're scouting those locations?
I'm just trying to find the best building that would have the best vantage point for me. So it depends on where I'm trying to watch, because usually when I'm going in, it's to watch an area. You know, you see all the movies where they give you a dossier of a guy and you go take him out. That's not what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was going into an area to where either it was heavily contested or there was enemy activity going on, to where the IEDs and things like that being placed, and I'm just trying to overwatch supply lines and make sure that those guys are getting through safely.
There were some times, though, when you were given photographs of specific targets.
There were a few times,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's got to be tough because you're working from far away. I mean, I guess you have equipment to help you see better, but I mean, what does it take to be certain that you're aiming at the right person?
Well, you sit there and you have to study their face before you ever go out. You have a picture of them and you're trying to study it. And then when you go out and set up, you have to set up close enough to where you can positively ID that target, because you can't make the wrong decision and kill someone who's not supposed to be killed.
So when in doubt, don't shoot?
Yes, ma'am. Hmm.
That's got to be stressful at times when you feel like you are almost there.
It is very hard. I mean, if you see him, and it's not even just that. If you see someone, some of the places we were with the rules of engagement, the ROEs, I could see a guy in the morning shoot a Marine. And then later that afternoon, I could see the exact same guy, but he doesn't have a weapon now. Well, I can't shoot him now because he has to be actively engaging. Well, he's not actively engaging, so you have to let him go.
You had, Chris, you lost some colleagues.
Yes, ma'am.
And for you, those felt very personal, those losses.
Well, anytime. I mean, these people were my brothers. They were unfortunately, my primary family. I spent all my time with these guys, and that was one of the tensions with me and my wife at home, was the fact that I had this other family. I was always gone. I was always with them. I knew them better than I knew my own wife. So it felt like losing a family member, and the fact that they died right next to me. I mean, it wasn't to where I heard about it. It was, I saw it.
Yeah.
I was right there.
We should say it's very interesting in the book because there are some sections where you have written your account of things, and then your wife also writes about what she was going through at the time. And there was this conflict between the two of you about how you should prioritize God, country, and family.
Yes, ma'am. I felt like country was for the greater good, and my family was just my own good. And I prioritized it, God, country, family. And my wife always said, no, it's God, family, country. And it always make her really mad when I would argue the point with her. And the fact that I constantly chose to keep re-upping in the Navy and go back on another deployment, that she really felt like I would rather go die than to be with her.
Was that true?
No, not at all. I did not want to die. I definitely wanted that. I am an able-bodied person. I felt like it was my duty to go do it. And that's one of the things I had a problem when I got out. There was some resentment with my wife because I felt like she forced me out. Mm-hmm. I'm able-bodied. I can still be doing it. But now instead, someone else is out there fighting in my space. And, you know, what if he got injured, or what if someone else got injured because I wasn't there? And I definitely took that personally.
You're also really candid about having to build relationships with your children. You shipped out when your son was 10 days old and when your daughter was 3 days old?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, that was definitely hard. I got to see my son growing up on a DVD, and that was difficult. And I come home, and he's walking, already starting to kind of say a few little things, and you miss all of it. And then when you do come home, it's not like, you know, I came home for that month just to relax, and the same time I'm coming home, I'm trying to take back over charge of the house, and my wife's mad because she's already been running it. She knows how it goes. She knows the feeding times, the changing times, and all the different habits of my son, and I'm just now trying to learn it and messing it up. And so it definitely caused a lot of problems, and then I turn around and leave again, go back to train, and then back to war again.
I know that you have consulted with the military about particular ways that snipers can be deployed, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I wonder if you were asked about what the U.S. military could do to make those re-entries and redeployments a little bit easier, what you would recommend. Is there anything that could have been done that could have eased those transitions?
It definitely could have been done, and they are doing it now. Mm-hmm. Whereas it was definitely difficult, you know, when we finished with our war. We got on a plane and we flew right home. So one day you're in a war zone getting shot at. Next day you're at home in your own bed. It's definitely difficult, something that it's hard to wrap your mind around. Now they are shipping the guys off to another location outside of the war and away from home, to where there is decompression time. And they have counselors that are there, and they have to talk to them. It's not saying these guys have problems with their minds, but it's just, all right, here's, we're going to talk about this. How do you feel? And just making sure no one's going to have any problems. And I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I guess on the one hand, you want nothing more than to be home in your own bed, but you really need that time, and you're not ready to be home right away.
Right. I mean, when you come home right away, it does end up causing problems. I've come home, and your nightmares that, you know, seeing your guys die or hearing all the explosions all the time, it happens as soon as you all of a sudden relax and let your guard down, and then there it is.
So from the perspective of your wife, your parents, your high school friends, I mean, they've got to worry about you getting killed all the time. They've also got to worry about you being a different person than the person who left for the first deployment.
Definitely. My wife said I did change, mm-hmm. that I became harder, more detached, and I'm sure I did. I mean, it's difficult. When you go over there and you see the things that you see, it's hard not to start putting up defenses and try to keep people away from you at arm's length so you can be the kind of man that the government expects you to be.
That was an interview in January of 2012 with 38-year-old Navy veteran Chris Kyle, who, along with his friend Chad Littlefield, was killed at close range at an Erath County shooting range on Saturday. Police say the suspect, Eddie Ray Ruth, was himself a military veteran whose mother had contacted Littlefield and Kyle, asking for their help in helping him deal with symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Of course, Chris Kyle's murder on Saturday is particularly ironic, given that he survived four tours of duty during Operation Iraqi Freedom and was recognized as the most lethal military sniper in U.S. history. He had 150 kills officially confirmed by the Pentagon. Very sad story that many in North Texas are still working to come to grips with. You can listen to that interview in its entirety. It was a full hour that we spoke with Chris Kyle in January of last year at keranews.org. We appreciate your attention to the story, to the show. We are proud on Think and on KERA to be able to bring you interesting stories about every aspect of human life, sadly, including those that turn out with very tragic results. We appreciate you listening to the program, and we certainly are saddened to hear of the death of Chris Kyle over the weekend.